Thank you very much, Matt, and thank you for your generosity. Is this working? Is this working?
No.
What happened? Did you pull it on me?
That's working, Matt.
Okay. Thank you, Matt. Thank you for your generosity. And the point Matt made is very well taken, is that the more votes we get, the more steps closer to all these things we want. Universal health care, living wage, and all the rest of it that will change the condition. That's what they look at in Washington, for example. That's what the media looks at. How many votes are these progressive campaigns getting? They know that trying to break the two-party dominance is like climbing a cliff with a slippery rope. So they're not looking for 20, 30 million votes. But we got more votes as a progressive third party in 2000 than anybody got since Bob La Follette ran in the 1920s. So they watch that very carefully. And they say, well, for every vote we get, there are people who would have liked to vote, but they were part of this two-party, don't throw your vote away, as if you throw your vote away for voting for someone you believe in. Again, Eugene Debs put it succinctly when he said, better to support the thing you want and not get it than support the thing you don't want and get it. So, anybody want to start?
Yeah, if anybody, am I on?
Yeah, no.
If anybody wants to ask a question, just come up to this podium, even though it's not really mic'd, and you can ask your question from here, just so everyone can hear you.
Yes, hello? Okay, yeah, there we go. So come on up if you'd like to ask a question, and you can ask on the mic here.
Where do we start in learning like more political sciences in our schools?
Where do you start?
Yeah, where do we start?
You start with your teachers. You start saying to your teachers, why don't we learn all this? Why is there such a gap between the best investigative reporting in the media and what we learn in school? A lot of times, is there, who's got control of this? Democrat, Republican? A lot of times, you know, the schools are a bit timid. I mean, if they, for example, want to teach you consumer skills, they would do what some schools have done. They would show you how to do comparative price comparisons in supermarkets on breadbasket items, the same ones, you know, and so you can see which prices are higher, which are lower, and then publish it for the community. That actually was done for a period of years in Indiana. Or they would have you go down, and if you had a complaint on something you bought, you go down to the small claims court. You don't need a lawyer, just need to describe your complaint, fill out a little one-page form, and explain it to the judge, and the judge will make a decision. Doesn't have to be Judge Judy either. You watch Judge Judy? Judge Judy? You know Judge Judy? I mean, you should, she's making more money than Oprah now. So let's say you're drinking water and you wonder if it's clean. Well, you would learn about the drinking water safety law that we got through Congress. You'd learn that you have the right to go down to your local water department and get certain information. And they're supposed to supply you periodically with information about, is there lead in the water? You know, is what's going on? So pretty soon, you get pretty confident. You get more confident. You get more confident. You don't just sort of wallow around and wonder about all these things that are affecting you. But the course can be called civics, civic skills, not just civics where you memorize things, civic skills where you, with your teachers, you analyze a problem in your town or analyze an injustice or analyze a need or analyze a solution, and you put your mind to it. And you might write a paper. You might have a class project. It doesn't matter whether it's elementary, high school. There's different levels of rigor that can be put, just like there is in mathematics or any other subject. But by the time you graduate, it'll be hard for people to push you around, for companies to push you around. whether it's a credit card company or whether it's a, you know, a car dealer or whatever, you know what your rights are. So you got to ask your teacher and your principal. Are you in high school?
No, I'm in the junior high.
Okay, ask your teacher and principal about it. Actually, there's a junior high school in Ashland, Virginia, where the students actually proposed this project. They said, here's a dollar bill. They had a dollar bill, and I get $2 bills. You ever see a $2 bill? Look, it's got the Constitutional Convention, 1787. You ought to ask your bank for $2 bills. Really good. Anyway, the dollar bill, one side of the dollar bill is, you know, what is this, all these designs? And so the student said, why don't we put the Bill of Rights and the Articles of the Constitution on that side? So people, you know, they're talking in a cafeteria or whatever, and they, you know, they start talking. What's First Amendment, Fifth Amendment? It's a real conversation starter. They got 120 members of the House to put a bill in to order the Mint to redesign the dollar bill. And then it just stalled 11 years ago. Looks like the vending machine industry got to some of the people on the Hill. But every year he has his students study the Constitution in the context of changing the dollar bill. It's pretty exciting. It only costs $500,000 to change the, you know, the machinery in the U.S. Mint to do this. And so I met them a few months ago, and they started reciting all the Bill of Rights and all the Articles of the Constitution. And so I said to the teacher, I said, is this just memorization, or do these youngsters really know what is behind these names, like the Fifth Amendment? And he said, why don't you try them? So there were about 15 of them. So I, how about you? What's the Seventh Amendment? They knew it all. Now, I think they were motivated because they were part of this effort to change the dollar bill in America. And one of these days, they'll get through. And in a few days, we're going to put out a press release urging all middle school teachers, social studies teachers, to get their children, their youngsters involved. It's one way to get involved in the presidential campaign, because the Constitution is under great discussion. It's being violated by our revered, unrevered president daily. It's being ignored by Congress, and it's really a hot period of our lives for constitutional understanding and observance. And they really feel like they're part of something big. So did that require more money? No. Did that require a new school classroom? New equipment? No. The greatest advances of education, although it's nice to have a decent school and good facilities, is all in the minds of the teachers, students, and principal. Those are great. Nice to have a school board, too. It's qualitative. You want to really get children to develop a thirst for learning. Good question. Yeah. Here, let me... Hold on. Let me give you a $2 bill with the Constitutional Convention. It's the only time I've ever given a questioner money. But I did it after the question, not before.
Can you keep one?
Yeah, you can keep one. $4. You can keep one. That's all right. These are brand new, right off the mint.
First of all, I want to say I'm honored to get a chance to ask you a question. I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I'm beginning to think a lot about that lately. And I have to say I'm quite proud of Joe Courtney's vote in this last debacle. I'm less proud of our state senator. Especially considering the fact that Dodd was in charge of many of the decisions that were made, and I fear for in a way that I haven't in a while in terms of our economy because of these decisions. And I appreciate, and I have little doubt in my mind that you would make a superb president. But realistically speaking, I would like to perhaps urge you to take up the state Senate battle against our Chris Dodd in the upcoming election that he's going to be running. I'd like to see you in Washington.
I want to rouse the country, and I'm a full-time citizen. I wouldn't have gone in electoral politics. I want to work on the government, encourage people to run for office. And you can have a national stage when you run for president, because a lot of people hear about you in all 50 states, and they say, well, why don't we run? Why don't we mobilize? Why don't we organize? If you just do it in one state, you restrict yourself. But anybody here wants to take on Chris Dodd? I almost got Phil Donahue to take on Chris Dodd years ago. I think he could have had a chance. It would have been a three-way race. He would have had a better chance. Yes.
Hi. So you've kind of had a lot of setbacks in your past presidential races. I know in 2004 you got some like 0.38% of the vote, and I think you're trailing like 45 points right now. I'm wondering, do you ever sort of think that your effort and money might be better spent going back to the basics of, you know, finding the next seatbelt and lobbying there?
That's a good question, but the doors are closed. I'm a realist. I don't go to work every day as a citizen advocate in Washington and have the doors closed where I don't even have a chance to have a chance to improve my country and still keep going. I want results. And so the answer to your question is, it would be great to continue to have done what I have done over the past years, but you can't do it anymore. We don't have the senators. We don't have the representatives. We don't have President Lyndon Johnson. Richard Nixon signed almost all these bills because he was afraid of the rumble of the people coming out of the 60s. He signed EPA, he signed OSHA, he signed Clean Air, he signed Clean Water. He hated them, but he signed them with very nice praising introductions. He's the last Republican president afraid of liberals. That's how bad it's become. When Richard Nixon looks good, by comparison. Tricky Dick himself, right? Looks pretty good. He had a health plan better than Clinton's. He had a rehabilitation plan for drug-addicted people instead of imprisonment. He had a plan to abolish poverty, minimum income plan, that Moynihan, who was his personal assistant, then drafted for him. The Congress rejected it. But look at, there hasn't been a president since that had an anti-poverty program like that and that proposed rehabilitation instead of imprisonment. That's how far down we've gone. When Richard Nixon, oh, geez, Richard Nixon. Some of you remember Richard Nixon, right? Okay. Thank you.
Ralph, real quick, can we see your Nixon impression? Just, I am not a crook.
I can't do that. I leave that given.
All right, I was on Saturday Night Live 5 times, okay. And the theater of the absurd that the two parties have made the presidential campaign. I mean, you know, the lipstick, the lapel, flag pin, that was worth 2-3 days. And whether Pennsylvanians cling to their Bible and their weapon, that was worth a week and a half. And the media is complicit in this, but when they don't debate really important issues, of difference, instead of you said this and I said that and you were, had different take 2 weeks ago, gotcha. And they don't say, well, what kind of tax system? What kind of foreign policy? Let's, you know, lay it all out in the big picture. Then there's a vacuum and it's filled with this gossip, tactics, gaffes, verbal slips. That's what happens. And so in the spirit of the theater of the absurd, I said, well, I got to reach about 2 million people. So I was offered an invitation I couldn't refuse, and that is to have a vigorous interaction with the puppet dog, Triumph, the insult dog. How many people have seen the insult dog? Look at that. So we had a real set to. He said he's going to put the whole 20 minutes on YouTube, but they boiled it down to 5 minutes. It was on Conan O'Brien. But they left out one segment where basically I said, in a tender moment with this unsavory, foul-mouthed dog, you know, it's a puppet dog with the comic under the table. I said, you know, I want to thank you, Triumph, because you've allowed me to reach 2 million people with my presidential campaign. You imagine anything more absurd than that? You have to go on comedy shows. You know, Jay Leno, Letterman. Here we have the greatest communication system the world has ever seen. television stations, radio, and so on. And I have to think, how do we get on Saturday Night Live? There's one for you.
Daily Show.
Yeah. Well, The Daily Show is good satire. It really is brilliant satire. I was on The Daily Show, and I was scheduled for The Colbert Show, but it was postponed. I hope I can get on that in the middle of the month. Certainly, he'd be more interesting to talk to than Triumph. Yes.
I'm sorry, I have to ask the question you've probably gotten a lot, but I remember in 2000 we heard the line that Bush and Gore are the same candidate, and 8 years afterwards Bush is as disgusting as you could possibly imagine any candidate ever being, and Gore is an environmental activist, and I hear the same line about Obama McCain. And if that is true, I mean, how can I digest that after looking back and hearing that in 2000 and then seeing what happened and the difference that could have happened?
See, you're angry at the wrong subject. If you ask Gore why he didn't go to the White House, he'd say, first, I won the popular vote. That's usually enough in most democracies. But the Electoral College, we don't vote for presidential candidates. No one has ever in American history. You vote for the electors, who nobody knows, right? Okay, so the first thing that took away his victory was the Electoral College, threw it into Florida. Gore will tell you 15 different ways that the Republican-controlled state government in Florida stole the election from him. I'm not going to go through each one. But he's also upset at 250,000 Democrats registered as such who voted for Bush. So the difference was five, before they stopped the recount by a 5-4 decision in the Supreme Court, the difference was 537 votes between. Every third party got more than 537.
I'm not asking about the 530 votes. I'm asking about the Bush and Gore being the same candidate.
Okay. Number one, unlike you, I'm not possessed by retroactive clairvoyance. When Gore campaigned, he wanted a bigger military budget. He was much more aggressive to Iraq. You remember, Bush said he wasn't going to nation build, and we had to be humble. It was Gore who was the aggressor. Just unbecoming. So he wanted more military weapons. He refused to make a speech on solar energy, on global warming. We tried to get him for 4 years to do that. He didn't, with Clinton, require the auto companies to upgrade their fuel efficiency standards. 8 years, he gave them a holiday. And just on and on. His record and his proposals were so weak that he lost the election. He should have landslided Bush if he really stood tall on a progressive platform. But be that as it may, you see, I come from a different angle than you're coming from. I say to myself, are those two parties the same in doing nothing about 58,000 people who die from work-related diseases? They're both the same. They've shut down OSHA. They shut down NHTSA. They anesthetized the Food and Drug Administration. The Pentagon never had more money after the end of the Soviet Union. So here's the question. How many of these passes are you going to give the Democrats, including they could have stopped Bush on the war, they could have stopped Bush on the tax cuts for the wealthy, they could have stopped Bush on the Patriot Act, they had the votes for a filibuster, they could have stopped Bush on all his Supreme Court appointments, and they didn't. So, you know, after a while you say, okay, the Democrats aren't as bad as the Republicans, they're both pretty bad, but at what point do you say the least worst is no longer good enough for the American people? And for 20 years, I had your attitude. 20 years, you know, hey, Mondale's better than Reagan, Dukakis, and so on. And all the Democrats do is totally ignore their progressive wing and continue to get worse and continue to dial for more dollars. So at what point, if you judge them on 30 major areas, do you say both flunk and we're no longer going to play the least worst trap game? That's the way you got to think it through. You know, you'll end up differently, maybe. But if you're just satisfied with the Democrats on one issue, Social Security, you'll vote for the Democrats. because that's your big issue. If you're pro-choice, you vote for the Democrats. That's your big issue. But if you take 30 major areas, like the military budget and corporate crime and the subsidy state and the Patriot Act and all these things, and the deficits both of them are ignoring so they put it on your children's back, then they both start sinking, 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 and at some point they flunk. They get a D. And if we don't have a breaking point, they will drag us into the abyss on the, well, we're not quite as bad as the Republicans. So the question is, what is your breaking point?
After 8 years of Bush?
Yeah.
My breaking point's been a failing economy, a failing war, a failing everything,
right.
So maybe the least worst might be better than the worst if going for the best ends us with the worst.
Do you ever think of making the least? Do you ever think of making the least worst better?
Yes, but
2000.
But what demands are you making on Obama? Right. Let's say you're going to vote for Obama. Because if you don't make Obama better, he's more likely to lose. Although he's got the easiest act in the world to follow. I agree, but. You see, if you're going to go for the least worst, you have a moral obligation to make the least worst better by your judgment. And most liberal groups do not do that. The minute they go for the least worst, they'll give John Kerry whatever he wants. And the corporations, of course, never give John Kerry whatever he wants. They're pulling in one direction, and the liberals don't pull in the other because they're least worst. So what demands are you making on Obama? What demands you?
I think we should move on, Ryan.
No, just give me one.
Sure.
Universal health care that is generally phased in over a generation rather than all at once, so it doesn't have to compromise to big industry like it did with Hillary.
You mean you'd have full Medicare for all?
What?
Would you have single payer?
If you try to go without compromise, you reach a stalemate and things fail.
We've had 63 years of compromise. And look what we've got. 18,000 people die every year because they can't afford health insurance. Pardon?
We have the most diverse country in the world.
What has that got to do?
On Cuba, then we lose enormous amounts of very valuable things. We get mired in an enormous war. We get mired in a horrible economy. If we stick fast to small things, we lose huge things that everyone needs. It is a person who wants universal health care. It is a person who wants a lot of the things I believe in. And I do believe that after he's elected, he'll be better, like Gore is. You're
like
right.
Clinton was.
He didn't look. What?
Like Clinton was. All the promises that Clinton made.
Like
you
Gore
see,
is.
Every politician is for universal health care. McCain is for universal health care. Gore, Clinton, Kerry. You cannot have universal health care without displacing the health insurance companies.
Do you think we can move on to just get one more question?
Yeah, hold on just a second. Yeah. You can't. No country in the world. No country in the world has gotten universal health care and left private insurance companies providing insurance, because they make money by denying claims, restricting claims, excluding claims.
The major health insurance companies backed Hillary's plan in 92.
Yeah, because
the people who are not for universal health care are small businesses, service industry, pharmaceuticals, and the plaintiff's bar.
No, see, now I know where he's coming from. The plaintiff's bar that stands up for people who are mutilated by medical malpractice, and he's blaming the plaintiff's bar. You know how many people die in this country? You know how many people die in this country because of medical malpractice? But according to the Harvard School of Public Health Physicians, 80,000. 80,000.
No, my mentor was a plaintiff's lawyer. I don't know if you know. Do you know Professor Baker? Tom Baker? I don't know. But the problem is you put doctors in fear. The doctors hate the plaintiff's bar. The doctors hate universal health care because they're afraid of this.
59% of the physicians in a national poll in April support single-payer universal health care without insurance companies being involved. You're wrong.
All right, First of all, I want to say thank you, and I've had a lot of respect for you. From the first time I saw you in 2000 to when I saw you debate John Michael Moore and Bill Maher when they begged you not to run in 2004.
Nobody forgets that.
No, I thought it was a great scene. But two quick questions. First one, do you think you've made an unfair target out of teenagers and youth culture by saying they listen to six times more music than previous generations or hip-hop?
Obviously no, otherwise I wouldn't have said it.
Right, so the thing is, if we looked at political movements in the 60s, the culture and the politics were absolutely inseparable, right? And in large part that was because of the music, because of the art. And it was, in my mind, the problem is the depoliticization of our culture. So,
of what?
Of our culture, yeah. And music, and you know, the corporate nature of everything that it is we engage in, mm-hmm. as a society. So that's the first question, and then the second question is, do you have any worries that by emphasizing the electoral process, you're implicitly de-emphasizing the need for people to get involved in direct action, direct democracy, kind of by suggesting, you know, if you elect the right people to stand up for you and, you know, make the decisions for you, you don't have to worry about doing it yourself.
Good point. We have a direct democracy platform where we can establish the procedures for binding national referendums with access to the mass media. And there are constitutional law experts at Yale and elsewhere who say that that is what sovereignty of the people means. They interpret we the people, they interpret Declaration of Independence, Federalist Papers, as authorizing the establishment of procedures for national referendums. You know, 22 states have state binding referendums. So, yeah, representative democracy, when it fails, as it did with the bailout, it has got to fall back and allow direct democracy to make the decisions. Now, that puts a burden on us. We have to spend time. We have to understand the issues before we go and vote directly, not for representatives, for issues, vote issues, like we vote single-payer in, we vote living wage in, like that. So we can't just do that without doing our homework. But nevertheless, if you want to really get responsible citizens, give them responsibility. The first one is, yeah, I understand music, you know, the political, cultural effects of different kind of music. I think the music today is not as good as the 60s in terms of the lyrics. Maybe that's why they have to listen to six times more music. And you know, you can get anything you want now, you can get to 60 music, but you have to ask yourself, there's 24 hours in a day, and don't you want to read something once in a while about history, and instead of listening to so much music? Yes, that's an indirect way, if I ever saw one. That's even worse than saying we learned French by studying Latin for 4 years.
Okay. We have one more question.
Why do you keep saying one more question, Dave? Let these people be heard.
Well, I just want to make one quick announcement. Okay, go ahead. I want these people to be heard. I just want to let everyone know, if you're interested in volunteering or organizing, we're going to be meeting across the hall after the question and answer session is over.
Very important. Please.
Please join us.
This is the result of these meetings. We have to get a good vote out here in Connecticut. You know, in the states that are going Obama or going McCain, that's where we should get a big vote. And we've got a lot of education to do. This business of giving the Democrats a free ride because they're not as bad as the Republicans is the worst trap the political mind can get into. Because their similarities tower over the dwindling differences between the two parties. Military-industrial complex, the same. Private corruption of money in campaigns and not going public, the same. Not doing anything about full health insurance. Even when the Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, and the presidency, they didn't do it, decade after decade. The subordination of workers to corporate power, the same. Clinton passed NAFTA. He got through, we almost beat him, but he passed it. He got through the World Trade Organization. This is the greatest loss, unnecessary loss of local, state, and national sovereignty in American history. This is what lets fascist and corporate dictators invite all too willing U.S. multinational companies to ship their industries and jobs to these countries who know how to keep the workers oppressed at slave wages and prevent all kinds of popular rights from being expressed and obtained. And then these workers who are very hardworking with modern equipment and modern management send their products back, these companies send their products back to the U.S. Who can compete? How do you compete against that? The Democrats, if anything, have been worse than the Republicans. On corporate subsidies, your money, the Democrats have been worse than the Republicans, although it's getting to be a close call during the Bush administration. They were far more willing to subsidize and give away public resources. You know, one can go on and on. The Democrats have not tried to repeal the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947 since 1947. No serious move, even when they controlled all two branches of government. And that means that tens of millions of workers didn't have the opportunity, as they do in Europe, to collectively bargain and get a decent wage and get a decent pension. I mean, how many more bypasses, how many more excuses do you want to give the Democrats before we say we have to have a third political force in this country and we're not waiting any longer? Too many people have suffered, too many people have died, too many people spend their waking hours trying to meet their bills and not have a time for the pursuit of happiness and spending time with their family. They're stuck in traffic, they're job and a half, they're rushing to get the kids out of daycare, $500 a month, et cetera. This young man is a perfect example of a low expectation level, a perfect example of needing to get more information, but a low expectation level. Watch out for low expectation levels. And the more the more yardsticks you evaluate political parties by, the more they drop. If you just measure Democrats by Social Security, they're quite a bit higher than the Republicans. But if you start measuring them on these big issues, some of which I just mentioned, I mean, don't we deserve better than this? This is ridiculous. I just heard a young man about 2 months ago in some place in the country I was at, can't remember anymore, so many. He stood up and he said, you know, I just graduated from university in Finland. And my entire tuition and fees were 56 euros, which is like 85 bucks. Finland. Finland's not the richest country in the world. But Finland basically says, you go to high school, you don't pay fees. Why shouldn't you go to college and you don't pay fees? But not the United States. The United States has soldiers in Western Europe and East Asia 60 years after World War II defending prosperous countries like Japan and Germany and France and Italy and the UK against who? They are perfectly able to defend themselves against who? Moldova, Inner Mongolia. If we bring these soldiers back, two things happen. We save $80 billion a year in upfront and backup costs, and we give these soldiers, along with all the other students in America, free tuition in every public university, not Harvard, every public university in the country, and still have $15 billion left over. Now, do you see the Democrats taking the lead on that? Do you see the Republicans taking the lead on that?
We need a senator to put those bills in order.
Yes.
My name is Megan, and I'm...
You're supposed to be Senator Sanders.
And I'm a medical student at the University of Connecticut and also a public health student. So I just wanted more details about the national health care plan that you envision, and if you were to be elected president, about how long you feel that could be expanded to include all the uninsured and the underinsured in America.
You do things that are long overdue. You do them based on the best research. The best research has been done by the Physicians for a National Health Plan out of Chicago. There are about 15,000 physicians supporting that group. They've worked out a meticulous legislation. It's largely in H.R. 676. In the House of Representatives, introduced by Congressman John Conyers with 93 supporters in the House, which is a good start. Basically, you replace, just like Medicare did, you replace the private health insurance companies like Aetna and so on, because there's only government insurance. you know, government health insurance. Government insurance, private delivery of health care, and your choice, free choice of doctor and hospital. And cost and quality controls, so the costs don't go out of sight and the quality doesn't deteriorate. Now, we are number 39th in our health care system in the world, according to the World Health Organization. Why? It's not because we don't have great medical school complexes like Peter Bent Brigham. You know why? It's because tens of millions have no health care coverage at all. That's the thing that really brought us down. And Western Europe and other countries are way ahead of us because you're insured the moment you're born. And in places, you're insured from cradle through nursing home. Just think of people who have to pauperize themselves in order to qualify for Medicaid in nursing homes. It's a nice way to end their life after they've fought and worked and sweat for our country. There's a man who was in the military, and he was about 60 years old. His wife just died. He had to devote his entire $300,000 in savings for her illness. And he got sick. And he went to a doctor who said, I can't do anything for you. You have to go to X hospital in Texas. He goes to X hospital, and he's signing in. And the clerk says, you have to present us with a $100,000 prepayment bank check before we let you in. Do you know how many drugs that you are prescribed that were discovered, developed, and clinically tested by the National Institutes of Health, your tax dollars, and then given free to one drug company or another to charge whatever they want? Do you know how many hospitals are supported with tax dollars? It's enormous. Half of the tax bill now is supported by your tax dollar, half of the health care bill. Half of the $2.2 trillion health care bill supported by your tax dollars. But you don't have any controls with that tax dollars. Your tax dollars are being used to provide enormous bureaucratic waste and enormous fake invoices and ripoffs of Medicare by these commercial health care organizations and practices. Now, there's one question that people ask. Well, if you do that, you're going to unemploy about 2 million people who work for the health insurance industry, the multiple bookkeepers, the accountants. And actually, the physicians who work this plan out have a conversion provision to provide for that. So they're aware that there are going to be some innocent workers who are going to lose their jobs. But right now, we spend $7,600 per capita on health care. 50 million people are not covered. 50 million are undercovered. Canada spends half of that, less than $4,000. They cover everybody. Switzerland spends half of that. They cover everybody. The people in Canada have their free choice of doctor and hospital. There are delays in Canada because the conservative governments have underinvested. They only spend 11% of their GDP on their health care. We spent 16% last year and had 50 million without coverage and 50 million under coverage. So a little bit more investment would take care of that. But there's no longer wait, is there, for health care than we can't afford any of it? That's the longest wait of all. And that's why the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Science estimates conservatively 18,000 Americans die every year because they can't afford health insurance. You can imagine how many additional Americans get sick, stay sick, or don't have their injuries attended to because they can't afford health insurance. So we're already paying twice as much as anyone is already paying any country in the Western world. So it's just reordering that $7,600 because when Aetna and Cigna spend 30% of your tax dollar on administrative expenses and executive salaries, that doesn't deliver any health care. When you replace them with government insurance, the government insurance administrative cost in Medicare is under 5%. So you liberate actually about $350 billion a year in just ending these administrative expenses and another $200 billion of computerized fraud and abuse. It's almost over $500 billion. Anybody who says, how can we afford it? The question is, in terms of lives lost now, injuries not treated, sicknesses not tended to, financial waste, how can we not afford it? You know, how can we not afford it? So just check, ask your congressperson or your senators for H.R. 676, and then ask them one question in your email. How come no senators introduced that? Not Senator Bernie Sanders, not Chris Dodd, not the progressive new Senator Sherrod Brown. These are the best Democrats we have. And they will not introduce it in the Senate because they don't think there's enough support for it. That's the real sign of a leader, isn't it? How many times in American history you had a minority of one that eventually became a majority? But if you don't put the bill in, there's no organization around it. It breaks the momentum that was building up in the House with 93 people when no one puts it in the Senate. And here we have the most progressive senator in the Senate. All you got to do is ask him, Bernie Sanders from Vermont, and he won't put it in. I'm going to be in Vermont very shortly, and you can be sure I will not ignore that absence of political stature on his part.
Become a senator.
How many times do I have to tell you the answer to that?
Okay. Someone's got to do it.
Yes, go ahead.
You've got the momentum there.
Go ahead.
Hold on.
Remember the two-party fix.
Yeah, but you have to break the system from the ground.
You can't break it as... No. You have to break it with a national movement, not with a self-seeking senatorial
all
run.
Politics is local.
With a national movement, my friend.
Where?
You might want to wait 1,000 years. Go ahead.
My name is Mike Lejoie, and I have a question for you regarding free trade. I'm against NAFTA, I'm against GATT, but what would you put to replace it?
First of all, we're the only ones who read it. The members of Congress never read the hundreds of pages. We proved that, because once we offered $10,000 to any member of Congress who could demonstrate in an open hearing that he or she had read the WTO agreement in the year they had it before the vote, we'd give $10,000 to their favorite charity. And nobody came forward, and so we extended it for a week, and the phone rang 15 minutes before 5 on a Friday, and it was Senator Hank Brown, Republican. He said, I'll take you up on it. I don't want $10,000 to go to charity. And he read it. He had voted for NAFTA. He was a free trader. And he reserved the Senate Foreign Relations Room for answering 12 questions, and he got them all right. And we praised him. Media was there. And he said, I'd like to make a comment. You're a senator. Go ahead. He said, I'm a free trader. I voted for NAFTA, but I read every page of this WTO agreement. I was so appalled by its anti-democratic procedures against the countries that would have signed it and its secrecy, I'm going to vote against it. And he did. That's because he read it. He wasn't working off sugar-coated 10-page memos prepared by companies or by the White House's U.S. trade rep. So how would we do it? First, we'd trigger the 6-month withdrawal notice that all countries who've signed it can avail themselves of, and renegotiate it. Here's how we renegotiate. All secrecy is eliminated, including the tribunals in Geneva, number one. So it's going to be out in the open. It's going to be like our Freedom of Information Act. Number two, the trade agreement will stick to trade. It will not subordinate labor, environmental, and consumer issues to the supremacy of trade. That's exactly the reversal of how we progressed in our country. When we abolished child labor, we told those factories that even though it was going to reduce their profits temporarily, they were going to be prohibited from hiring these children who should go to school. And what did that mean? That meant that we subordinated their profit-seeking impulse to the supremacy of a human right, or a worker right, or a student right, whatever, children's right. Now WTO and NAFTA have got us with an albatross around us. They subordinate labor, consumer, and environmental standards to supremacy of trade. Here's how it works. If we were pushing airbags after WTO was enacted, we couldn't get it. Why? Because the proposal to put airbags in cars under WTO would go to what is called an equivalence procedure. And you get all these countries, and they would deliberate what standard it should be. And we only have one vote. St. Kitts, 69,000 people in the Caribbean, has one vote. India has one vote. Luxembourg has one vote. You can see how powerful we are in that kind of council. In short, we couldn't have issued the airbag standard. We couldn't be first because it's a low common denominator situation. The California Food Labeling Act would be wouldn't have been enacted. Why? Because other countries who export food to us say it's very onerous to put labels on our produce that we're exporting to the U.S., and that is trade restrictive, and therefore, even though it might be good for consumers, it's bad for trade, therefore, it's illegal. And they take us to the courts in Geneva, and we lose. We've lost 5 straight environmental challenges by foreign countries. Now, what in the heck is a trade agreement doing trespassing on environmental health, worker health, and consumer rights? So you eliminate that, and trade sticks to trade. The third and most important thing is we have to fix how we revise it. There's no way we're going to have the same vote as St. Kitts. This is a corporate ploy in the name of full democracy. But countries that have 200,000 people in them are not going to be given the same vote as countries that have 700 million or 500 or 200 million. So now, what do we do with consumer, labor, and environmental? They have their own treaties on a level playing field. They're not subordinated to trade, to commerce. Human values, health and safety values should never be subordinated to commercial values. If anything, it should be reversed, just the way it was when we abolished child labor. Now, do you see that discussed by Obama? Do you see that discussed by McCain? They've had 18 months to discuss it. They've had endless time to discuss it. And every day is the same as every day, the same speech. I mean, I've heard Obama's speech now on C-SPAN 15 times, and I almost have it committed to memory. I can summarize it this way. Hope, change, hope, change, hope, change, change, hope, change, hope, change, hope. Am I beginning to hypnotize you? Am I beginning to hypnotize you? On his behalf, he was asked about that months ago. After he vociferously came out against impeaching Bush. How do you like that for the least worst? The Democratic Party, when they gained control of Congress, knowing how many high crimes and misdemeanors Bush has committed, criminal war of aggression against Iraq, systemic torture, imprisoning Americans without charges and denying them habeas corpus, snooping on millions of people without judicial approval. That's a first-class felony with a 5-year jail term, by the way. And hundreds of signing statements where he gets a bill from Congress and says, I'm signing it, but I will decide whether or not to obey it or enforce it. Now, the American Bar Association, 400,000 lawyers, many of them conservative, sent Bush 3 white papers in 2005, 2006, saying that in 3 areas, he is seriously and continually violating the Constitution. That's not just some left-wing lawyer saying that. Bush never bothered to respond. So the Democrats knew all that. What was the first thing Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, and the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid did? Impeachment is off the table. That's like saying to the criminal Bush and Cheney, hey, you can keep doing what you're doing. And guess what? They did. They did. Now, because they'd say, I asked them why. I asked John Conyers why. He was told by Speaker not to have impeachment hearings. He said, number one, it would be too divisive. Number two, that's Obama's rationale. Number two, it would take attention away from our legislation, distract attention. Number three, they don't have the votes. Well, you know, they're the majority party. They certainly got a good start, right? you know, I mean, where would the civil rights movement have been, I asked Congressman Conyers, who I've known for years, if that was the attitude. Okay? Yeah, well, of course, they built it. The hearings build the evidence, the hearings. They don't even give us hearings on impeachment.
But why?
I just told you why. You can't understand it because you don't understand the extent of political cowardliness in Congress, perhaps. There is no rationale. These members of Congress swear to uphold their Constitution. Okay? In the Constitution, there's a provision for impeachment. It's the only authority in our federal government to fire a president, vice president, or cabinet member between elections. So it's a pretty somber provision by our founding fathers. Okay? When you take the oath to uphold the Constitution, you take the oath to enforce that provision. We know the Democrats believe that Bush has committed high crimes and misdemeanors. And not once with the Watergate burglary. Day after day in these five major areas. And what kind of precedent? By rupturing their oath of office and shelving this impeachment provision that they should be enforcing. What kind of precedent are they setting for future presidents? I said to them, when you have an oath to enforce the Constitution, and you know that that president has violated it in five major ways day after day that fits the definition of high crimes and misdemeanor, because you've told us that privately, and you're not moving with that provision, you, the Democrats in Congress, should be indicted for obstruction of justice. You are engaged in obstruction of justice. By the way, you remember when Obama was excoriated because he had a flag pin, and then one day it wasn't there? And that took about 3 days. You remember that? Back and forth. Well, here's what I would have done if I was him. I would have said, let's say there's a flag here. Instead of, you know, back and forward and this and that. See that flag? You know what that flag stands for? The last words of the Pledge of Allegiance. It stands for with liberty and justice for all. Not for a few, not for some, but for all. That flag was never designed to be a gag in the mouths of the American people to stifle dissent, the way Bush has used it. It was never designed to be a bandana for reckless and illegal wars of aggression. And it was never designed to be a fig leaf to cover the shame and the outrageous violation of our Constitution by these political charlatans in the White House. That flag can take care of itself, but our Constitution cannot take care of itself. We have to take care of it. It starts with the phrase, we the people. And so I, Barack Obama, will not wear a flag pin on my lapel. What I will do is wear the Constitution.